Tonight we discuss part four in the series, The Torah State. Part four, Social Justice. We're sponsored again by Becky Navikatz, Rehila Nishmas, Yonah Ben Aryeh Leib, Tein Nishmaso, Surah of Itzarachai. Social justice, simply defined, is the application of principles of justice and fairness to all aspects of society, economics, law, family life, especially as it relates to society's concern for the downtrodden and the disadvantaged. So some we've already discussed, like economics. Last week we touched on the dispute that exists, loosely drawn, between economic liberals and economic conservatives on whether social justice requires economic egalitarianism, that is to say, through taxation of the wealthy or income redistribution, etc. You more or less equalize the distribution of assets in a society. Or does social justice require free markets that rather than seek equality of result, you seek equality of opportunity? And as long as the markets are accessible to all, then that's what's basically fair and just. So Torah largely favors the latter, but that we discussed last week. The law angle will be discussed in Lecture 6. Lecture 5, by the way, is a culture in the Torah state, which I hope will be very interesting. Not that tonight won't be, but I hope that especially is. Tonight we'll discuss the other aspects of social justice. For example, the income gap that can exist in a society. What's the Torah ideal? How does the Torah deal, for example, with differences between people in levels of education or opportunity or talents or intelligence that renders some people advantaged and some disadvantaged? How does the Torah view the safety net of which we hear so much today? How does the Torah feel? What would the Torah do to engender unity or harmony? What precisely is that value in Jewish life as opposed to diversity? What does the Torah say about that? And how do we bring society to a point where we can say that justice prevails? So let's take up the first topic, which in any society usually gets the most attention, and that's the differences between the rich and the poor, the so-called income gap or income disparity. It's much lamented today. You hear it in American society, certainly the last 20, 30 years. Israeli society also the last 5 or 10 years. Now, granted, for an economic conservative, much of this is contrived. Contrived meaning that if the rich would average, say, $100,000 a year in income, and the poor $20,000 in income, so then the income gap is $80,000. But if everyone gets wealthier and the rich now average $500,000 in income and the poor, so to speak, $100,000 in income, well, the income gap grew. It's now $400,000, but everyone is better off. So just speaking in terms of a disparity between what the wealthy earn and the non-wealthy earn is a little misleading, and it's not necessarily a vice. Nonetheless, there are certain social tensions that are caused as a result. And in most of the world, if you see wherever there's unrest in the world, invariably it relates to some type of economic deprivation. Except in the Arab world, they're always not resting well. But elsewhere, even Nepal or Africa or parts of Europe, it always relates somehow to, or South Central America, always relates somehow to stresses that tear at a society because of the gaps between rich and poor. Now, understood that some societies define poverty differently. Some societies define it based on proportionality, which is not always fair. You know, we have poor people in American society, but if you take the poor in American society and stack them up against the poor in India or Sudan, the poor in America who have TVs, color TVs, and air conditioners and automobiles, live a much better life. So there is this aspect of proportionality. You have to make it relative to the situation. Yes, 98% of Americans have color TVs, and 2% probably Haredim. But the poor, you know, they spend money on that. In fact, I was reading before the Super Bowl, there was a rush. People were going to these stores even to rent short term. paying inflated rates to get TV. So a part of society's ills stem from a misplaced allocation of one's resources. But nonetheless, that doesn't change the basic fact that in any society, whether it's the American poor or the Indian poor, the poor will always feel a certain alienation from the mainstream. And that's the point that we have to talk about. The main problem, of course, except if you have no bread, is kinah, jealousy, envy. Kinah destroys life. It destroys a person's happiness and sense of contentment. It's the cardinal sin of any society to see what someone else has and covet it for yourself. Jealousy just begets a treadmill of misery and despair and frustration, not to mention the prohibition of losachmod. And that really is the primary problem in dealing with what people call the income disparity that exists. Especially in a society where people are very easily aware of the lifestyles of the rich and famous, it just cultivates a sense of jealousy that filters down and leads to unhappiness. The Torah prefers to define poverty not by proportionality, but by basic levels of subsistence that are not met, either because of a lack of income or because of a lack of capital that the person has that can be or sometimes need not be liquidated. So we're talking about a subsistence level. Before we get to poverty, let's talk about wealth. I gave a shiur on this in the beginning of February, so I'll just summarize it in 1 minute. Those who went to the shiur, it took 50 minutes, so don't tell anyone, I could do it in a minute too. The pursuit of wealth is permissible according to the Torah. There are many sources that, in fact, favor wealth. Certainly, the common person does. The Rambam, true, advocates the midah beinonis of money for chayei nefesh only. That is, a person should work so he could meet his bare needs. Beyond that, it is wasteful. But others disagreed. Rabbi Yaakov Emden said, in giving a charge in one of his svarim, he says, "Bacharu b'midas ha'osher." You should choose the value of what, the attribute of wealth, acquired be'amuna uv'yosher, with integrity, honestly. Wealth is a gift from God. That's the pasuk in Mishlei, Birkas Hashem Itashir. The person who's wealthy is blessed by God. Rav Kook said, this is an Ein Ayah in Brachos, that pursuit of wealth is not bittul Torah. And one is allowed to acquire, against the Rambam, even yoter me'echrech sipuko. A person can acquire even more than he needs for his simple, a simple style of living. Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin said that Misha makir b'nafsho, a person who recognizes in his soul, in his personality, that he needs wealth to serve God, is allowed to seek it without any inhibitions at all. And of all people, the Mishnah Brewer, the Chafetz Chaim, who was an extremely destitute individual, said that a person who wants to increase his wealth, it's a mitzvah. Why? It's a mitzvah when he'll use his enhanced bank book to give more tzedakah or to invest in businesses that provide employment for poor Jews. So in fact, wealth helps the individual. It facilitates shmiras ha-mitzvos, the Talmud Torah. It allows for, in Rav Kook's language, harchavat dat and shalvat ha-nefesh. It allows a person to have an open mind. It broadens his mind. It gives him some serenity of the soul. Allows for a full expression of the human personality. And as we'll see, allows a person to do many good things in society. But conversely, jealousy kills. Jealousy is the worst possible midah. By the same token, wealth brings a number of challenges that must be dealt with as well. The fact is, there's no perfect economic state. It all depends on the individual. A person can be happy in any condition. The studies say that the middle class is usually the happiest group in society, but no one in the middle class would turn down more money if it was given to them to elevate them to the next level. So you have a classic destructive dynamic in society that the poor envy the rich and the rich condescend to the poor. The social justice of the Torah state demands that this be rectified and eliminated. And the question is how. the rich have to develop a certain attitude to the poor that is the product of good midos. So the Gemara says in Brachos on David Zion, a number of tefillos that the Chachamim had, some of them we say every day. One Yiratzon, it's right after the Birchas HaShachar, this most of us skip. But Rebbe himself, Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi, was a very wealthy person, was mispal every day, Shetatzilena mi'azus ponim. He should be saved from impudence, brazenness, arrogance. So Mefarshim explain, what's the arrogance? The wealthy have to pray that no one should be jealous of them. They have to be spared that. The wealthy have to feel that the poor are their equals before God. Beautiful medrash on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Roshei Halayich Ka'Karmel, the Roshei Halayich, which is the heads, are like ears of corn, but Chazal Darshan, Roshei Halayich Ka'Karmel, God says, the Rosh is a poor person, are precious to me. The Dalas, I forgot the part, Dalas Roshech Kagamon, the Dalim, the indigent, they're like David HaMelech to me. So God feels a special affinity for the poor. So should the wealthy person. It's demanded of the wealthy person that he seek out the poor. Again, not in a condescending manner, but socially. For conversation, to greet especially them when he sees them on the street or on Shabbos, befriending them, making them part of his social circle. So certainly a wealthy person can't embarrass someone who's poor or lord it over them or flaunt his wealth in their faces or think that he's necessarily smarter than them or worthier than them. But nonetheless, a wealthy person has to incorporate the poor in his social circle. The Yalkut Shimoni says in Balak, he's Zohar b'vnei aniyim shemehem teitzei Torah. Be careful how you treat the children of the poor, because Torah comes from them. Torah comes sometimes from the children of the wealthy too. But nonetheless, it means that wealthy people have to struggle to overcome materialistic tendencies from which one has to withdraw in order to learn Torah. The children of the poor don't have that because they lack those tendencies to begin with. So it's clear, the Halacha says, a rich person has to seek out poor people for meals, to have them in his home. It's not enough to hire people to do chesed, they should do it themselves. You can't just write a check to Tom Cheshavis. You should have to fill a box every now and then and deliver it also. You have to visit their sick especially, comfort their bereaved especially, leishei v'imohem, to sit with them socially. The Gaon Mivilna said very insightfully, you have to sit, the rich should sit with the poor, because this way the rich too will be content. If wealthy people only associate with wealthy people, which unfortunately becomes a tendency in many communities, it will only fuel their jealousies, because they'll see someone has a 40-inch flat screen TV, they didn't have to have a 50-inch. They have three-car garage, they need another 4 cars. So if the wealthy only associate with the wealthy, there's a kin amongst them as well that will just drive them batty. But when they're with the poor, they're content. Suddenly whatever they have, they feel that they're blessed with, and therefore they need not seek anything more. And the rich must live in such a way that they do not provoke the jealousy of others, which is a big problem in our world too. The Chavos HaLevavos said almost 1,000 years ago, the Shaar HaBitachon, that there was one town in Europe, he mentioned, so he was in Spain, but there was one town, Rabbeinu Bachya mentioned, where all Jews wore the same color clothing. I think it's Bnei Brak, by the way, but they all wore the same color clothing in order to eliminate haughtiness and competition. So it wasn't for religious reasons, they all wore black. They all wore one color. So everybody then, there was no competition in terms of dress. Think, you know, school uniforms, that's the idea behind it. Shouldn't be any competition. One shouldn't be buying shirts that cost $200 and someone else's shirt costs $10. It's also a way to look at the world. Yaakov Avinu, when he sent his sons down to Egypt to collect grain, to purchase grain, so Rashi says that Yaakov did not suffer from the famine. He had grain. He was very wealthy. So why did he send his sons down? The Torah says, Lomo Tisra'u. Why should you stand out? Everyone else is hungry. Everyone else is starving around you. Why should you stand out in society? People will think that you're better than them. And no one said it's stronger than the Kliyogar. In the beginning of Devarim, it's Penulachem Tzofono, so the Kliyogar has a discourse there about the great failing of generations. He was in Prague, it's the 1700s. The great failing of generations that will yet haunt Jews is the way we flaunt our wealth in the faces of the non-Jews. Instead, he said, that's the pasuk, Punu lachem tzafona. Tzafona is always an indication of wealth, and tzafona is from Lashon Matzpin, like tzafon and the Seder, tzafun, dafikoma. We should hide our wealth. If you flaunt your wealth in front of the non-Jews, eventually there'll be a price that Jews have to pay for it. So if a wealthy person approaches his wealth from that perspective, we're not even talking about how he's spending it, or what he's giving to the society, giving back to the society, but if he approaches wealth from the perspective that it does not define him and doesn't entitle him to special status, and on the contrary, seeks the company of those who are not on his economic level, then everyone benefits from it. So too, leaders are not allowed to favor the rich over the poor. It seems obvious. It's not so obvious. Not in shuls, not in communities, not in countries. The famous story, one of the most moving stories in Isha Halacha, Halachic Man, or Rav Soloveitchik, is his grandfather, Reb Chaim of Brisk, once was confronted with the following situation. There was a shoemaker who died early one morning, and the Chevra Kedisha prepared to deal with him, and then one of the wealthiest people in town died a few hours later, and the family gave money to the Chevra to bury him first. Shouldn't have to wait for the next day. And Reb Chaim heard about it, and sent his emissary to the Chevra that he would put them all in Chayrim if they were metapa with the wealthy person before the shoemaker. Because the halacha is, you die first, that's the priority, you go first. And in the end, the Chevra caved and they agreed with Reb Chaim. What are the obligations that a wealthy person has? So, in terms of the Torah phrases this, the categories, tzedakah u'matnasaniyim, you have a category of charity, and matnasaniyim, specific things that the poor are entitled to. Now, Western society, largely to its credit, created the welfare state 70 years ago, which for a time was almost exclusively a series of unending payments to the poor that were designed to satisfy their most basic needs in terms of food and housing, and preclude social unrest, prevent people from rioting in the inner cities. The welfare state in the United States developed a bad reputation as it fostered dependency and neglect, antisocial behavior, slothfulness, unemployment, generations of welfare families, and invariably was demeaning and unsuccessful. So in the 90s, it started to change, and it has mostly transformed the society, which most municipalities today have what's called workfare instead of welfare. There are limits placed on the amount of money a recipient will receive, as well as the length of time they'll receive it, and by and large, except for exceptions, there is a requirement that they work somehow in order to receive that money. That work, which was interpreted at the time, in the mid-90s, by liberal advocates as punishment of the poor, was actually therapeutic. It's been successful, as it restores to them a sense of dignity and independence, and enables the recipients and their children to overcome the culture of dependency which arose in American life and really held generations back. Now, tzedakah is considered a right of the poor, and it's considered the property of the poor that awaits collection. It's almost an accounts receivable. The poor have the right to tzedakah of the individual and of the community to care for their needs within certain limitations. Pasuk says in Mishlei, Al tigzol dol ki dalhu, do not rob the poor because they're poor. So Medrash says in Bamidbar Rabbah, Parsha Hay, that this is a reference to matnos aniyim, leket shikcha peah, the produce that's made accessible to the poor, as well as to maaser ani, to which he's entitled. And if the rich do not provide that, so it's not only a sign that the rich are overlooking the pain of the poor, but the Medrash says he's gozel mimenu mashenasa l'Kadosh Baruch Hu. He's actually stealing, robbing from the poor that which God gave him. Meaning God gives us an excess of what we have, If it's in excess, it belongs to someone else. That's what gives the poor a claim to this. Granted, no individual ani has the claim to any particular usher's wealth, but nonetheless, in a general sense, it is a right and a claim and it's property. Now, matnos aniyim also chip away at the fantasy of ownership, which very often afflicts the wealthy, as does Shemitah, by the way, in which his land is construed as ownerless. Both permit the poor to just enter his property and take defined produce or locations of produce. It's as if he owns a field, but he doesn't really own it. The corners of the field are not his. His workers may glean what they leave behind. They're not his. They belong to the poor. But they belong to the poor. It's not charity. It's really chiyuv. It's an obligation. And the poor, the wealthy, of course, must bear in mind, the Gemara says in Sukkah, Daf Chaf Amid Beis, that nichse balabatim nimsar l'malchus, that the property of people is confiscated by the government when they promised tzedakah and don't give it. If you promise, make a pledge, and don't fulfill it, eventually you lose that money anyway. If it's the poor, it's an investment. If you don't give it, though, the government seizes it as only they can. Related to this, by the way, is a tremendous isser, which I think we're very often nichshel at, and that is the isser of lotol and kula sochir, not to delay the payment of a worker. We're obligated to pay wages on time. The per diem worker, you have to pay that day. Because you can't say to a worker at the end of the day, I'll see you tomorrow. Oh, shyly, when you can give him a check, because a check he can't cash after the banks are closed. If it's a job, you have to pay when the job is finished, when the makes the demand. And if you don't, then you violated Baltolin. You violated that iser. So people, and this unfortunately happens too often, even in our community, they'll string along a contractor, or a merchant for that matter, and merchant is not baltolin, but a contractor is. It's not a baltolin, but it's a different issue. But the merchant, a contractor, though, or a worker, a gardener, etc., when they make the request, that's the day of payment. And especially if they do the work that day, and they're paid that day or that day of the week, whenever they come, etc. It's a big issue we're very careful about. Apropos of something I said a few moments ago, hachnasas orachim for the poor. So the Rambam says in Hilchos Yom Tov, the famous Rambam, she'ochel v'shose, when a person eats and drinks on Yom Tov, chayiv lahachil lager layosom v'almona im shar aniyim ha'umlolim. You have to feed the stranger, the orphan, the widow, with the other unfortunate poor. That's hachnasas orachim, not friends. People you're not friends with necessarily, but who need the consolation, need the encouragement. Avamisha Noel Dalsas Hatsero, a person who nails, who locks the doors of his courtyard, and he eats and drinks who von of Ishta, just he and his wife and children. And he doesn't give food to the poor, to those embittered of spirit, Einza Simchas Mitzvah Ela Simchas Kreisa. That's not Simchas Mitzvah, it's just the Simcha of his stomach. It's just the physical pleasure he's having, but there's no spiritual value in such a meal on Yom Tov. And of course, a little late for this year, but on Purim, it's far better to increase one's Matanos Levyonim than one's Mishloach Manos or Seudah. Matanos Levyonim has that status, giving gifts to the poor. Well, conversely, the poor have obligations to the rich as well. And this is something that we should also be aware of. The poor have an obligation to honor the rich and to defer to them. Mar says in Nedarim, Rebbe Mechabed Ashirim. Rebbe is wealthy himself, but he'd be Mechabed Ashirim because he saw in them people blessed by God. In fact, the Kitzel Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Chavtes that the poor should think that God has blessed the wealthy person with wealth. Mistama roi hu lekach. If God sees fit to bless him, he must be worthy of it. Note that a wealthy person is not allowed to think that. It's one of the cases you have in the Torah where there's one attitude. In one person it's unseemly, and another person it's welcome. A poor person is allowed and encouraged to think that if someone is blessed with wealth, mistama roi hu lekach. Even if a wealthy person is not allowed to think that, because that would be arrogant. The poor are also commanded not to be envious. Mikino tova machlokes. the Orfa Sadikim writes, from jealousy comes strife. Also, the poor are obligated to find employment and to exhaust all means of sustenance, relatives first, before turning to the public. How do you handle chronic cases? People who refuse to work, people who, for example, refuse to buy life insurance or health insurance, and then when things go sour, they turn to the community. So that's a chronic problem. That's a problem in every society, every Jewish society as well, that people just won't. They won't buy health insurance or life insurance. They'll say, in time, we'll deal with it. Then they die, the community deals with it. If everybody did that, then there'd be no insurance at all. The communities would be bankrupt. So different communities dealt with those situations in different ways. The problem is that when it comes to the individual family who's in that position, who never prepared for that rainy day or that dark future, it's hard to turn down a family in need. On the other hand, you want to encourage responsibility as well, and that's what the Torah advocates. In the Torah state, therefore, the gap between rich and poor has no practical significance, because if everyone carries out his obligations in halacha and in musar, then the gap is meaningless. It matters as much whether a person has X amount of dollars or one-fifth X amount of dollars than it does that this person is tall, this person is short. It doesn't matter at all. We wouldn't say that only tall people should socialize with each other, so why do we think only poor people, only rich people should socialize with each other? It also recognizes that each person is placed in different situations, and recognizes further that every person in life experiences a variety of circumstances in life, because money is a galgal chozer, it's a wheel that turns. Some days it's up, some years it's up, and some it's down. And therefore, we all find ourselves in situations where occasionally we have to turn to others for assistance. The broader point is, and this is a crucial Torah principle, money does not define the person. And a person should never define himself by the quantity of money that he has accumulated. How much one has says nothing about the quality of the person. How he spends what he has says much more. One related point, interesting machlokes in Chazal, will there be poor b'masa Mashiach? When the Mashiach comes, will there still be poor people? So they took psukim in Devarim, Parshas Re'eh, not far apart, that would seem to conflict. One pasuk says, Ephes, ki lo yebucha evyon, there won't be any poor. And a few psukim later it says, ki lo yechdal evyon mikarev haaretz, the poor will never cease from the midst of the land. The Sifrei writes there that there'll be no poor at all in the Messianic era. That's Kiloy B'cha'evyon. What about Kiloy Yachdal? It won't stop. So he says that's only when we don't do Ritzon Shel Makom, we don't follow God's will, which is not an issue in Yemasa Mashiach. Or it maybe applies to non-Jews. That's Evyon B'Kerev Haaretz. But the Rambam disagreed. The Rambam said his basic approach to the Messianic era, in any event, is Olam Kimin Hago Noheg. You can't legislate the business cycle out of existence. No one can, not even the Melech HaMashiach. So even Yemasa HaMashiach, those who are prosperous and those who are not as prosperous. Everyone, though, will find it easier to earn a living, that the Rambam makes clear, because of technological advances, as we see already, but they'll still be poor in the society. Others explain differently. The Ritva says that there'll be no Evyonim, and Evyon is someone who's destitute, as opposed to an Ani who's just poor. So there won't be any Evyonim anymore, but poor people there will be. It's written on Shabbos, Samaf Gimel Amud Aleph. And the Chassam Sofer says there will be Evyonim also, but the Evyonim will be content because it's Yemasa Mashiach. Everybody is happy. They'll be content. So therefore you won't have the strife that otherwise might exist, the unrest that exists in societies where income disparities. So it seems to me that there will always be poor, that's the pasuk, kil yechtal evyon bekerev haaretz, for another reason as well. Because poverty, like other life situations, gives people an opportunity to do chesed. So now we come to social services. What are the social services that the Torah obligates a community to provide? So first, of course, as we've been discussing, is the alleviation of poverty. Shmos Rabba, the Medrash Rabba and Shmos in Parsha Lamed Aleph says that poverty is the worst of all Yisurin in the world. Poverty, Gemara says in Erevin Daf Mem Aleph Amud Beis Mavir Nasalda Midaito Midaito Valdas Kono. It drives a person out of his mind, causes him to lose his sense of well-being, and causes him to be distant from God as well, because he feels the weight of the world on him. So poverty hurts a person in mitzvahs, in Talmud Torah, in health, physical health, emotional health. A person loses a sense of self-worth. He cannot maximize his potential. It affects his home life. It can lead to social isolation. So never believe that poverty is a virtue or valued in Jewish life. And as it says in Chazal, Yoa ani yusol yisra, the poverty befits a Jew, but only in the sense that it reinforces a sense of humility, not as an absolute. And poverty in a Torah state is a chil Hashem, because it's a sign that Jews cannot care for this person, and that the Torah life cannot be sustained. One byproduct of poverty as a chil Hashem is an explicit halacha that unfortunately is regularly violated today. One is not allowed to take money from non-Jews. How Jews take welfare, and some achronim justify it because people pay into the system. But it's a chil Hashem that Jews have to turn to non-Jews for support. What's the system? Well, Franklin Roosevelt, in one of his four freedoms, was the freedom from want. The freedom from want is society's responsibility. How is that done? Is the Rambam in Hilchos Matnos Ani in Perek Tes. Just read a few halachos. Kol Ir Sheyesh Bo Yisrael, any city that has Jews in it, Chayovin Lohamid Mehem Gabay Tzedaka Anashim Yiduim V'Nemonim. You have to appoint charity distributors, people who are well known and trustworthy. Shemachzirin Al Omer Shabbos L'Rav Shabbos. They would go door to door from Friday to Friday, collecting from each person Mashiroi Litain V'Davar Katzavolov, just collecting the amount of money that they'd be taxed to support the poor. They'd give money to the poor every Friday for their needs for the next 7 days. This was the Kupa Shel Tzedakah, which is very famous. They'd come around with a basket, and everybody would put in the basket the money that they were obligated to give, and the Gabay Tzedakah would distribute it. Also, you had separate Gabayim who'd go every day from courtyard to courtyard, and Jews would beg pas, minimachal, peros, or even money, and they would put those in a plate, and they would distribute it for the daily needs of people who were not being supported weekly but needed some help that day. That was a plate, the charity plate. Now the Rambam says, we've never heard of a Jewish community not having a kupa shel tzedakah, a charity basket. It's a staple in every home, but certainly every common institution, like a shul. There's a kupa shel tzedakah right there on the bookcase. Aval tamchui, but the charity plate, yesh mekamo shenagubo, yesh mekamo shelo nagubo. Then already it depends. The plate which was for daily distributions, well, that depends on the community because it may not be necessary or warranted. So in fact, you see in the Jewish society, the Torah state, they must have bureaucrats that are charged with alleviating poverty by allocating society's wealth. And it's a great mitzvah to be a gabay tzedakah. Both daily needs and weekly needs are looked after, and this is the safety net in a personal sense. But what's its applicability today? The Chazon Ish said that there's no need for the Tamchoi today. Remember, they were talking mainly about food, bare subsistence. But the Chazon Ish said, he died in the early 50s, he meant even the 30s and 40s, certainly more today. Today, people don't look for that daily bread. Bread is cheap. What a person needs to survive is money for a home, for furnishings, for clothing, etc. And this money came from two sources. As we discussed last week, taxes on the public, as well as private tzedakah, and they work hand in hand. So the Tovei Ha'ir, the council, always determined who was worthy to receive tzedakah and how much that person would receive, and they would also determine how much each person should pay. It was sort of a progressive tax system. in that they would assess the amount of wealth a person had and affix an appropriate percentage. Now, Aruch HaShulchan notes that it has to be done very sensitively and very carefully. Certainly taxes should not ever be onerous. And he writes something which is as true today as it was then. If you would just confiscate all the money from the wealthy, it would still not be enough to support the poor, right? So those who want to tax the wealthy, I always tell them, if you would just take every last dime that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have, just take all their money, which together is about $110 billion, it would run the American government for about 20 days. Then what? So you have to be very careful what the tax rate is, the limitations. These limitations were in Lithuania, for example, of course against frauds, of course against profligates. In Lithuania, they barred people from going door to door except for Hachnasas Kala, and they had to have relatives in Lithuania, at least at one time in the Lithuanian Jewish history. Now, even if taxes are kept on a reasonable rate, there's still the understanding that the poor will have a lower standard of living than the rich. That's just the way it is. The Torah phrases the mitzvah of tzedakah in terms of de machsoro, in accordance with what they lack, their deficiencies. And the famous example Gemara Sanhedrin offers, and Ksuvos as well, whatever he needs for psychological well-being. So Hillel Zaken himself, once a person lost his wealth, he had a horse and a man running before him, so Hillel went and bought him a horse and ran before himself. That's De Machsoro. But De Machsoro is a Chovas Tzibur, it's a communal obligation, not an individual obligation, and it's subject, of course, to other needs. If there are no other needs, no other priorities in town, then of course you can give the guy his horse and his runner. That's not common today, so we have to then allocate based on priorities. Reb Chaim held, though, that a person has a chiyuv, has a yochid to give tzedakah, and a separate chiyuv as part of the tzibur to respond to the needs of the tzibur. So if a person, say, would be visited by the gabbai tzedakah on Friday, and would give his share, and then Ani came by on Monday for a pruta, he couldn't say to the Ani, I gave, you know, at the office, I gave to the gabbai tzedakah already. No. He has one chiv as an individual and a separate one as part of the community. But if the standard of living of the majority improves, there should be a corresponding improvement in the standard of living of the poor. So that also makes for more harmony in society. But what if the standard of living goes down? Let's say there's a recession. So in fact, contra to prevailing conservative economic theory today, halacha is that taxes should be increased during a recession when times are bad, because the poor suffer more. That is to say, the wealth they're able to get by with less, much better than the poor can get by with less. So he has to give more tzedakah, not less. And justice is that the wealthy lower their standard of living and give more during a recession to help those people who are suffering more. They have to take the hit because they are better able to absorb it. What's the method of distribution? Priority of allocation. So again, Hilchas Aniyim, Hilchas Matnasim, Perek Yud, the famous Rambam, there are 8 levels of tzedakah. The highest level is not to give tzedakah in the traditional sense, but Hamachazik Beyad Yisrael Shemoch, to strengthen the hand of the Jew who's fallen. If you see a Jew who's coming on hard times, the highest level of tzedakah is v'nosei lo matono, o halva, o osei mo shutafus, o mamzi lo malacha, to give him a gift, give him a loan, make him your partner, or find him a job, kedei lachazek es yado achli tztarech labrios l'shav, give him a job to strengthen so you won't have to turn to people for assistance. That's the highest level of tzedakah, because that type of tzedakah retains the person's dignity. And it's not demeaning at all. You're letting him work, you're making him feel like a person. The lowest level is to give grudgingly. In between the lowest and the highest, there are gradations. The second best is to give completely anonymously. Neither the giver nor the recipient, or their identities are known. That also preserves the dignity of the poor. That's why the Medrash says Avram's tent had 4 entrances. So a person can walk in one way, go out the other, no one knew what was going on inside. And of course, always to give b'sever panim yafos, to give to the poor cheerfully. Poor, of course, has to be defined. Poor means poor. Poor doesn't mean a guy just collecting for some organization, but it means the actual ani. This way, the ani feels better, sometimes just with a smile. He can have a small amount of money to give. We try to return him to his customary standard of living, even the modern poskim say, the standard of kashrus that he's used to, or whatever minhag is a dog. If svardim are stringent on eating Beis Yosef meat, so tell him to get different meat. No, he has a right to be supported enough, he can buy Beis Yosef meat. It's far better to have a central distribution than it is to have a person go door to door. Now, there were communities that tried to ban door to door mendicants. Sometimes the thought crosses our minds here as well, but many held it cannot be banned, that it's midas zdom. Some did. The basic rule, which also we breach more often than we would like to realize, is aniye ircha kodmim la'aniye ir acheres. The poor of your town takes precedence over the poor of any other town. So if they're poor in Teaneck, that's our primary responsibility, absent any other situation. In terms of aniye ir acheres, machlokas, whether aniye Eretz Yisrael take precedence over aniyim anywhere else, some say, I think some say that Ani Eretz Yisrael take precedence even over Ani Yircho, but that might be a minority opinion. But clearly, Ani Yircho, the people we live with, the people we should socialize with, the people we have to strengthen, they always take precedence. That's the welfare system. It's not designed to be permanent. It's designed rather to be Machzik B'Yad Yisrael Shemoch, to uphold, to lift people up, so they'll be able to work for themselves. There are other social services that the Torah state provides, all subject to the test of reasonableness. Let's say you have an alien, not from a different planet, but an out-of-towner. So foreigners are entitled to emergency medical care, they're entitled to temporary lodging, and they're entitled to food. What about residents? Residents have a greater sense of entitlement. The community has to provide for them a home, and medical care, and hachnasas kalah, and tuition assistance as well. Now, medical care seems obvious because of losan adam reacha. You can't stand by and watch someone die. Even to care for one who causes his own fate, a person who's a habitual smoker, you still have to care for him despite the consequences. It's always best to pay physicians. I know the physicians maintain that, but that's what the Gemara says too. In Baba Kama, Daf Pehe, Amar Aleph, Asir de Magon b'Magon, Magon Shofer. A doctor who charges nothing is worth nothing. But you like that. You may not like the next point, though. What about the poor? Of course, a vexing issue today in American society, the issue though is more health insurance, health coverage, more than health care. Sometimes that's conflated and distorted. But nonetheless, you know, there's a big push now to have a centralized national health care system. Which, if you look at the rest of the world, I don't think Americans would desire that necessarily. The only type of centralized healthcare system we have today is in the Veterans Administration, and no one is extolling their treatment the last decade or so. The Gemara says, the famous Mishnah, the end of Kiddushin, Tov Sheba Rofim B'Gehenom, at the best of the doctors go to Gehenom. Rashi says, why is that so? That you don't like. Why is that so? Because Rashi says they can treat the poor and they don't. They prefer to treat the paying customers and not the others. So in fact, in Jewish society, in the Torah state, Beis Din requires a rotation of doctors to treat the poor. They should give one day a week, half a day a week to treat the poor. There are Hashulchan writes in Chashin Mishpat, Kuf Samach Gimel, Se'if Aleph, that the basin has the right to force people to establish hospitals for the poor. Just for the poor. Now granted, those types of hospitals do not necessarily provide the best health care. On the other hand, they could and they should. The Tzitz Eliezer says that a patient has the right to demand a good doctor. In fact, a patient can say, I don't want to be seen by an intern or by a medical student. I want my doctor. He has that right under halacha. In a Torah state, therefore, it's really the best possible system you can think of. It's a combination of private health care and public health care. Private for those who can afford, and public for those who cannot. And the way the public system is managed is with doctors who set aside time to treat the poor. Hospitals are maintained from the taxes collected by the Tovei Ohir. So they set aside time to treat the poor, but granted, they can't leave one patient to treat another. Patients are treated on a priority basis or on a triage basis, first come, first served. Now, there's a limitation to this as well. Of course, we speak about the poor, and we certainly don't want to blame them for their predicament. However, the Torah was very insistent that a person not fall into this state. Here's again from the Rambam and Hilchos Matnas Aniyim. La'olam yidchok adam atzmo v'yisgaldel b'tsa'ar v'yitztarach labrios. A person should always force himself and even suffer tremendous grief and pain and not turn to others for assistance. He says in Berachas HaMazon, by the way, lo'lim manas b'sar v'dam. We should never be in a position where we need it. V'yashlich atzmo al atzibur. A person should not throw himself onto the community for support. It's the mandate that we all have. I spoke about this a few months back about the tragedy. A person should turn his Shabbos into a work day, into a weekday. Not work, God forbid, but a weekday. You won't have fancy meals. You won't have three or four courses. Better to have one simple course, and don't turn to people for assistance. Even if a person was respected and wise, and he became poor, he should find some trade. Even a lowly, despicable trade, and not turn to others for help. This is the Gemara quoted last week in Psachim. It was an Aramaic then, he wrote in Hebrew the Rambam. Muto lufshot or behemos nevelos v'lo yomar la'om chocham godol ani kohen ani parnasuni. Better that a person should flay carcasses in public, which was a despicable trade because you reaped from it, and you shouldn't tell people I'm a chocham, I'm a kohen. It's beneath me to do such work. Parnasuni, support me. So the leaders must be very careful in how they tax and how they allocate, not to arouse resentment because of both frauds and malingerers as well. While we're talking about getting jobs, so wages in the Torah state should be commensurate with the job, but also with the standard of living that exists. It's no sense to have a job that's necessary for a society, like a street sweeper, for example, that does not allow a person to be self-sufficient. So any job which is needed in the Jewish world, the wage has to be adjusted so that a person will be able to live a decent way. Now, social justice very often comes down to, and a society is defined by how it treats those under special circumstances. And at this, the Torah excels. Ko almona v'yosam lo sa'anun, the Torah says in Mishpatim. You're not allowed to torment a widow, an orphan. The Torah speaks very eloquently, passionately, about the responsibility of society to care for widows, for orphans. Divorcees are included with widows, strangers, converts. So Hashem, in our tefillos, is defined as Shomeres Gerim. He preserves the stranger. He's Avi Yisomim, the Dayan Almonos, the father of orphans, and the judge, meaning the advocate for widows. So we have to be especially solicitous of their feelings and their dignity and their spirit to show more concern for their needs and their money and their sensitivities than for anyone else in society. All these people feel somewhat outside the mainstream of society. What's the mainstream? Families of born Jews. That's the norm. Anyone who's outside that because of death or poverty or they converted to Judaism, they feel like outsiders on some level, so we have an obligation to make them feel like insiders, even more part of our world. Thus, the Almana, the Yosam, were exempt from many taxes, even if they were wealthy. Interesting. I heard a story once from my Rebbe that
in Eretz Yisrael, he was from Gateshead, so one of his Rebbeim of Gateshead once went to a dinner at Buckingham Palace, and instead of greeting the queen first, he went to greet the queen mother. Forget her name. Went to greet the queen mother. So someone said to him, how can you go to the queen mother first instead of the queen? The queen's the reigning monarch. So he said, it's because the queen mother's in Almana. That's why. She's also in Almana. Her husband died in 1952. So he went to her first. That's the way a Torah Jew looks at the world. Including this, of course, even if they're wealthy, they were exempt from many taxes simply because they feel downtrodden, they feel put upon. Included in this, of course, is the obligation to give special attention to those with special needs, whether children or adults, whether physically challenged or mentally handicapped. The Torah state protects their rights. Protects their rights in a very vivid way. The Torah adds an isser to whatever is done wrongly to them, the prohibition of tormenting them, bal ta'anun. So in fact, if you steal, if you cheat an almana, you're guilty of two sins, cheating and bal ta'anun. It's another lav. We have a klal that if people are waiting in court to have their cases heard, so the din of the Talmud Chacham goes first, because his time is precious. Except when there's a yosom v'almono. The din of a yosom and almono take precedence even over that of a Talmud Chacham, because if they don't go first, they will feel they're being shunted aside simply because they're outside the mainstream of society. Or the Torah gave a Kohanim who were Bali Mum, blemished, who could no longer serve in the Beis HaMikdash doing the Avodah, they had rights to Karbanos as well. They shouldn't feel, just because they have a Mum, it's not their fault that they're not entitled to what the other Kohanim have. Or they gave special access to the elderly to Peah. Peah means a corner of the field was left for the Aniyim. So Chazal would let the elderly go first, a special time, just so they should go before the others came to take. They also shouldn't feel put upon. Moshe Feinstein has a Truva Igris Moshe. You're allowed to, a blind person can bring a seeing eye dog to shul. I spoke about this the Shabbos. We had a blind person here with a seeing eye dog. And allowed hearing aids on Shabbos as well. Rav Ezra Batsri, the poskim in Eretz Yisrael, even permitted a Shliach Tzibur in a wheelchair. Think about it. Down for the Amud, you know he has to sit, because those are his legs. I'm just saying, this is the sensitivity of the Torah. So this whole area of special people with special circumstances really demonstrates the beauty of the Torah and how the society is geared to those who feel left out or put upon or distressed should be made to feel at ease and included. That's the sensitivity that the Torah engenders in the Jewish soul. And all this is a function of Kovod HaBrios. All these people have no natural advocates. So the Torah becomes their advocate, and the Torah asks that we, every Jew, become their advocate as well. Social justice also involves strengthening the family. So we believe that it doesn't take a village, it takes a family. The family is the basic unit of Jewish society, not a village. Rav Kook said, the Jewish family is holy in a way that's much more profound than in the rest of the world. So the Torah has a very clear bias. The bias, of course, is in favor of marriage. We encourage marriage. There's no chaya issues outside of marriage. And of course, once people are married, we encourage them to stay married. One task of the Gaboi Tzedakah, primary task, was to marry off the poor. The children of the poor were less desirable shidduchim. I don't think it's any different today, by the way. But one of the obligations of the Gaboi Tzedakah was to marry off Davka, the children, the Yosom, the children of Amonos, and the poor as well, and a special fund set aside for that. The Torah structures its tax and economic and social policy to promote marriage and to sustain marriage. You can't sell a Sefer Torah, for example, for anything, very few things, because the holiest object that we have. You can sell a Sefer Torah to pay for a wedding, to marry someone off. Even Yom Kippur, as we know, Benos Yerushalayim would run out to the fields to find their mates. Even Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year. Shana Rishona, the first year of marriage, the Torah exempts men from the army, from public service. And of course, the famous Tshuva of the Rosh, we look for every way to free an aguna so that she will be able to remarry and find happiness elsewhere. One aspect of this is the freedom to marry. Person has to marry, man has to marry at least to fulfill prur revu. Women are sort of necessary in that context as well. A man is allowed to wait, though, to marry isha shalibo chafetz, a woman of his choice, even though we favor young marriages as well. Now this is subject to the isurei chitun of the Torah, it's a list of arayos, a person can't marry those people, but it's not subject to the Torah's, to the parents' choice. It's something which I always run into some contentiousness with when I raise the issue. But it's an explicit and open ramah in Eben Ezer. I'm sorry, in Yoredei, in Hilchos Kibud Av V'Em, a child need not listen to his parent who tells him not to marry or tells her not to marry this person. The child has to live with the person, with the spouse, not the parent, and it's the child's choice. And it says it a little differently, but that's the ramah. He's very clear about it. It's the child's call. Women, of course, cannot be married against their will, according to the Torah, nor can they be divorced against their will since Rabbeinu Gershom's time. So the fundamental objective of a Torah state is shalom bayis, that there should be harmony in the Jewish home, and that then filters out to the rest of the society. Today, sad to say, marriage is disposable. The average person in America, I think, has 2.3 mates. Where they get the third of the mate from, I don't know, but I'm sure we'll find out. Marriage itself is a value, but it's not highly regarded, hence the attempts in America to redefine it. But in Israel as well, Rav Bar-Ilan writes of a case, just to show you the difference in perspective. There's a couple that was feuding, came before the Beit Din Rabbani for divorce, and as the Beis Din always does, they refer the people for counseling, for shalom bayis, sent for counseling. Right as they started, the husband said he wants to leave the country on business. And the Beit Din Rabbani said, no, he's not allowed to leave. We're dealing now with a marriage, shalom bayis, you have to take care of the home front first. Man appealed to the Bagatz, the High Court of Justice, and they said the freedom of movement is a more important right than marriage. So therefore they let him leave. It's just a difference in conception of what marriage is and its importance to society. So it's forbidden, for example, for anyone to foment strife between a husband and a wife. One cause of the Churban Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara says in Gittin Daf Nun Ches Amud Aleph, was just that. A would convince B to divorce his wife, and B would, and then A would marry them. The Churban comes from such things. Conversely, it's a mitzvah to bring about peace between a husband and a wife. You know, the Mizbeach itself sheds tears over a marital breakup because the home is sacred. So we have a bias in favor of marriage that manifests itself in a number of halachos. So Rama says, it should be clear, you're allowed to be mater neder to bring peace between a husband and a wife. A case in the Dorab, the Afsanach Rabbah and Beis, Bava ben Buta, the famous Tana, allowed a woman to break a lamp over his head in order to bring about shalom bayis, because the husband had said, told basically to do that. So she said to her, you're a holy woman for following the will of your husband. He didn't mind. I might mind. He didn't mind. God allowed his name to be erased. The Parsha Sota, the Shem Hashem, it's erased in the water, all in order to allow a Sota to return to her husband. Such is the importance of shalom bayis. A similar case to Bava ben Buta, the Medrash in Dvarim Rabbah, Parsha Hey, Remer allowed a woman to spit in his eye in order to bring about shalom bayis. You see, Chazal allowed themselves to be degraded, to be humiliated, in order to ensure that Jewish homes remain intact. Here's more bias in favor of marriage. Strange as it sounds, halacha is a woman is not believed if she says she had an affair, tells the husband she had an affair, therefore you must divorce me. She's not believed. Shema nosna ineho bacher. Maybe she has her eyes on another person. It's the Gemara in the Dharm, the Chzadi Amit Beis. We don't believe her. She may forfeit her ksuba as a result of that, but he's under no obligation to divorce. He can if he wants to, but he's under no obligation. I think even more tellingly, a number of the modern poskim have the following case, arose, Rahman al-Islam. If someone knows a wife had an affair, there's no obligation to tell the husband about it. None at all. This in order to prevent a divorce. But they say, Yabi Omer, the Ben Ishchai, the Nora Yehuda, Reb Shlomo Zalman, they all said, there's no obligation. If you know someone, if you see someone coming out of a motel room, and you're coming out of the next room for whatever reason, you have no obligation to tell the husband that anything. Unless it's witnessed by two Eidim, two Kosher Eidim. If the home is the basic building block of the Jewish society, of course it's the place in which we raise our children and train them to be the next generation of Jews. That's the place where the Mesorah is transmitted, and therefore its stability is a primary value. The last value in terms of social justice is, of course, the need to engender unity in the Jewish society. If everyone had perfect midos, it would be very simple. I always say the surest way, the clearest path to Jewish unity is that everybody should just agree with me and do everything that I want. The problem is there are about 10 million other Jews who have the same basic approach. Therein lies the problem. But nonetheless, we must be able to bridge the gaps such as they exist between rich and poor, between men and women in the family. Also, another hierarchical structure in Jewish life between Talmidei Chachamim and Amei Haaretz, well-known antagonists. The envy of the Amei Haaretz for the Talmud Chacham is fierce and relentless. So says the Gemara in Psachim Daf Mem Tesmet Beis. Rabbi Kiva said when he was an Amei Haaretz, if I saw Talmud Chacham, I would want to bite into his leg like a donkey bites through a bone. That's how much he would hate a Talmud Chacham. So therefore, knowing this, the Talmud Chacham must always act benachas, pursuing peace and harmony, even though the Talmud Chacham by nature sees the Amei Haaretz as wasting his life. Nonetheless, the attitude the Gemara took in Brachas Daf Yud Zayim and Aleph, Ani Birya v'chaveri Birya, I am a creature, my friend is a creature. I work in the city, he works in the field. I do more, he does less. So what? Echad hamarbe v'echad hamamid, uvulvad shechavin libel hashamayim. Some do more, some do less. As long as they focus on serving God, that's what's important. So Rav Kook says here, on this Gemara, that the Talmud Chacham has to perceive everyone as his equals in worth, to respect them and to love them as well. Talmud Chacham has to judge the Amei Haaretz favorably, not feel haughty, not embarrass them. The halacha was manipulated in a way that if a person tried this today, he'd be excoriated as a rebel if he tried such a thing. So Amei Haaretz were considered tameim. Couldn't eat their food in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. If a Talmud Chacham touched one, he had to go to the mikvah, except on the regalim. Chazal paskened on the regalim, on the Yom Tovim. Every Jew came to the Beis HaMikdash. The Amei Haaretz were considered tahorim. Why? Rashi says in Beit Zadav Yadal from Beis, Shalol Levayshah. So as not to embarrass them. So every Jew should feel that connection. Such arrogance in the Talmud Chacham, the Gemara says in the Dharm, Daf Chay Aleph, Amud Aleph, will prevent his own children from becoming Talmidei Chachamim. So we maintain that every Jew is precious. Afilu kefela harimon rakaseich, afilu reikonim shevecha, melei mitzvos kerimon. Even the empty ones amongst the Jews are filled with mitzvos like a pomegranate has seeds. Part of unity is the ability to avoid machlokos in Jewish life. Machlokos is worse for Jews than for non-Jews, Chazal say, because we have a dual role of Mamlechas Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh. There's nothing that's worse in a Jewish society, the Gaon Mivilna said, than a Baal Machlokos. A Baal Machlokos you can even call an Amaleki, because they were Baal Machlokos. In any dispute, therefore, mitzvah lefasher. It's a mitzvah to find a compromise. A Jew is lauded for not insisting on every right, even if the law is on his side. For this brings about peace in society. People who are litigious, even if they're always right, they're still considered Bali Machlokas. The Gemara says in Chulin, Daf Peites Amud Aleph, a person who is silent during a Machlokas justifies his existence in the world. The world exists for such a person. Any shul has a Machlokas, Maseches Derech Eretz says, Sofo Lechoreh, eventually it will be destroyed. Who's to say, but how many shuls have been destroyed in our history? Machlokes is like a raging fire. The Geula won't come until we are Aguda Achas, one band. So this, of course, is a global ideal, but it's first a Jewish ideal, to recognize the sameness, the equality in others. So the Gemara says, famously in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, man was created Yechidi, Mipnei Shalom Abrios. So there should be peace. A person should not be able to say, Adam was created as an individual. So people shouldn't say, my father was greater than your father. Because we're all descendants of Adam Harishon, we have the same father. You can even change the liturgy to prevent strife. It's amazing how Chazal thought. The Magen Avraham says you can call a Kohen for Shlishi. Why? The case was your Gimel Midos. The people in the shul fought over it, and the Rav was a Kohen. Call a Kohen for Shlishi, and he's called Shlishi Afal Pisho Kohen. That's the text in the Ramah, by the way. Even though he's a Kohen, he's being called Shlishi. Why? Just to prevent Machlokas. Or you don't do Malacha Erev Pesach after Chatzos in a place where the minhag was not to. Mipnei Machlokas. You find many times the Gemara says, or Chazal, so the Poskim say, something is done or not done, Mipnei HaMachlokas. One purpose of the mitzvos is to connect Jews, not to divide Jews. One hallmark of Yemos HaMashiach is there'll be no Machlokas between Jews. And that's a prelude to Shalom Ba'olam, to peace in the world. And of course, every Jew has an obligation to make peace among Jews whenever he can. In summary, the social justice of a Torah state is premised on v'ahavt l'recha kamocha, to love your neighbor as yourself, whether it's the rich or the poor, talmid chacham am haaretz, husbands and wives, parents and children, employers, employees, even to litigants. So v'ahavt itself inculcates good values and allows the person to pursue happiness and fulfillment and respect his neighbor's pursuit of happiness and fulfillment as well. If it sounds like a pipe dream, it's only because we limit our love, usually, to those closest to us, or those who do things for us, or those who are precisely like us. But if we would draw a slightly wider circle, and then an even wider one, we would see that with good midos, we can acknowledge the differences that exist in Jewish life, personalities, and minhagim, see everyone as equal before God, everyone, in Rav Dessler's famous phrase, playing different instruments in the same orchestra. That's not only within our reach, but that day is much closer than we think it is. That's the social justice of a Torah state. I thank you very much. We next meet then Monday night, May 5th, Amir Tzashem. Be well. Next time, we'll talk about the culture of the Torah state.